We begin this second day of worship on factual statements in legal discourse. Now we have the presentation of Lewis Ross, which is assistant professor at the Department of Philosophy, Logic and Scientific Method in the, at the London School of Economics. And his presentation has the title Civil Blame. The floor is yours. Thank you so much for coming.
Great. Can everyone hear me at the back? I think this is the longest table I've ever given a presentation to. It reminds me a bit like, do you remember when Vladimir Putin during the pandemic was sort of speaking to his aides and they were very much on the other side? It's got that similar vibe. So I might stand for a bit and then sit down when my legs get tired. Okay, so today I'm going to be thinking about blame in the civil law. So I guess this is a classic question of legal theory. It's one that I've only just started to think about. So I wanted to use this talk as an opportunity to get my thoughts straight about what role moral blame plays in the civil law. This is really a work in progress, so any questions will be very helpful. Any literature suggestions will be very helpful. So this isn't a fleshed out talk or anything like this. It's a sort of programmatic introduction to how I've been thinking about this question. So on the face of things, the civil law seems to be highly suggestive of moral blame in many cases. When we find someone at fault in the civil law, this often seems to imply moral blame. And this is so for a number of reasons. So for one, the civil law often employs what you might think of as everyday moral concepts. So most obviously, tort law is centred around the concept of negligence, which seems like an everyday moral concept that we're all familiar with. Civil law discusses cases of breaking of promises, of dishonesty, and it often involves the use of deontic notions such as duty. So these are everyday moral notions we use in our day-to-day life, and it seems like these also appear in the civil law, not just in any sort of fringe way, but in fact right at the core of what the civil law does. Secondly, sort of judicial dicta often appeal to moral notions quite explicitly, either when justifying legal positions or when discussing the parties involved. For example, they might often criticise parties involved for their conduct in terms that sound moral. So for the first of these, judicial dicta that justify legal positions, so the classic case in Anglo-American law on the duty of care is Donoghue versus Stevenson. And the judge says, well, in this case, introducing this notion into the common law, the judge says, I think it was Lord Atkins, says, well, liability for negligence is no doubt based upon a general public sentiment of moral wrongdoing for which the offender must pay. So right at the introduction of this sort of core aspect, central aspect of the civil law, you find explicit reference to moral notions. Thirdly, civil law often judges people against standards of behaviour that correspond to what you might think of as everyday normative expectations, the sort of expectations we expect people to uphold in their everyday life. So canonically, you might think of reasonableness conditions. What would the reasonable person do? This seems, at least arguably, to be comparing parties to a legal case to some moral notion of what's expected for the average person to do, what's reasonable given the circumstances. Maybe even more tellingly, civil law can also range over conduct that is, in other cases, criminal. So in many jurisdictions, perhaps every jurisdiction, there are many things that are criminalised, such as homicides, arson, assaults, or rape. These can also count as civil wrongs, right? There can be a crime of rape, there can be a tort of rape, there can be a crime of assault, there can be a tort of assault. And what happens when you're found responsible for the civil tort of assault is you're being attributed responsibility for the assault. And in many jurisdictions, or at least in Scotland, where I'm from, the tort of, say, sexual assault is definitionally equivalent to the crime of sexual assault. The judge says the civil tort just inherits the criminal definition. So what the civil court seems to be doing is saying, hey, this person's responsible for a crime, and if you think that crimes are generally predicated on the notion of moral wrongdoing, Again, it seems like the civil law is really involved with blaming here. And finally, and sort of most sort of trivially, civil law ranges over sort of harms of great moral importance. So destruction of environmental resources, protection of children, of workers, mismanagement of financial resources. There's lots of morally interesting stuff that goes on in the civil law, and it seems the natural position would be to suggest that when people mismanage or fall foul of the protections around these different things, what they're doing is something morally problematic. So that seems to be a sort of, I think, from a first glance, I think you would naturally conclude the civil law involves a lot of moral blame type of activity. In the literature, which I've not surveyed exhaustively, this is a very much sort of shoot first, ask questions later academic talk, I suppose. But in the literature, you find various treatment to the idea that civil law involves blame. So one paper describes it as the common layperson's view that the civil law does not involve blame. And then another paper, you know, 5 to 10 years later says, well, it's conventional wisdom that the civil law involves blame. So you get this classic thing where academics describe the view they have in mind or the view they want to target as the sort of classic view, but it seems like lots of people say different things here. But it seems to me quite obvious the civil law, at least in a suggestive sense, involves moral blame. So what might you say if you don't want to go down this strategy? Well, so there's one strategy you might take to debunk the idea of morality in the civil law, which you might call the heroic strategy. So some people try and analyse legal materials, doctrinal materials, and case law, and say, well, actually, the way these things are used in the law is nothing like the everyday moral sense. But I think it's going to be hard to do that for across the board, right? Especially if you think of crimes that are also torts. It's going to be really hard to say there's no correspondence between these faults and moral notions. A different strategy that's more promising to try and decentralise moral blame from the civil law is to appeal to the function of the civil law. So one might say, well, look, the function of the civil law, the sorts of things we decide to protect using the civil law, the function here is not about allocating moral blame. I think that's a much more plausible strategy, because after all, as you'll know, there are many stories about the function of civil law, of tort law, of other areas of law that aren't sort of blame-centric. But even if it's right that the civil law doesn't sort of essentially or necessarily involve blame, there are going to be lots of cases where it seems to incidentally do so, where the content of the verdict seems to involve attributing blame, even if the function of the whole system isn't predicated around assigning blame. So the question is, well, what do we say about these cases where the civil law, at least in an incidental sense, seems to involve blame? Okay, so that's the suggestive setup. Civil law seems to involve blame. There are ways you might try and decentralise moral blame from the civil law, but they're still going to leave untouched lots of cases where finding someone civilly liable seems to involve blaming them, even if the function of holding them liable isn't to assign blame, if that makes sense. Okay, so why is this an important question? Well, I think, for one thing, if there is a very close relationship between civil fault and moral blame, it seems to have some sort of thorny or difficult consequences for sort of big picture legal theory. So a very common view in criminal law theory is what's distinctive about the criminal law is that it invokes moral blame. So if you think about the work of people who work on criminalization or punishment, so I'm thinking of like modern retributive theorists like Anthony Duff, what they say is, well, look, the canonical thing about criminal law that makes it distinctive is that it involves moral blame. So a common thought is that moral blameworthiness is necessary, even if not sufficient, for criminalising and punishing someone. So that's one aspect. A second aspect, and this is the aspect I'm going to focus on today, is a procedural question. So another common thought in criminal law theory is that moral blame, or the threat of moral blame, is what justifies the demanding procedures we use in the criminal law, procedures that tend to protect the potentially innocent person. So think about the standard of proof, the thing I'll focus on today. The standard of proof in the criminal law, Anglo-American law, is, and many countries have analogues of this, standard of proof in the criminal law is beyond reasonable doubt, while in the civil law it's merely the balance of probabilities. So it's obviously much harder to prove something beyond reasonable doubt than to prove it on the balance of probabilities, more likely than not. So why is that? Well, a common view says that the criminal law uses a high standard because it involves the threat of moral blame. And in the criminal law, it's really important to protect the potentially innocent, right? So this is a huge procedural difference between criminal and civil law. Okay, page 2. So what it means is if the civil law does involve moral blame, all of these sort of what are approaching classic views in criminal law theory and legal theory seem to be somewhat unsettled. So various distinctions between criminalization and civil fault seem to lose their distinctiveness of what makes us put one into one category and one into another. But also I think, and this is the thing we're going to focus on, the use of weaker safeguards for the defendant in civil law are called into question. Because at least notionally, the civil law has this indifference regarding different types of mistakes, right? It doesn't. The civil law doesn't regard it as more or less important to avoid false positives than false negatives, because it uses this balance of probabilities standard. While the criminal law, of course, is very much concerned with avoiding false negatives. But if civil law involves moral blame, the question is, well, why don't we afford civil defendants the same heightened protection that we afford criminal defendants? And that's what I think is a big looming threat if we accept the idea that civil law involves blame. I think this becomes quite difficult, or at least interesting, to ask why we would have such an asymmetry between the two. Okay. So to warm me up to this idea more, I want to go through some hypotheses in a sort of very cursory way as to why we use a high standard of proof in the criminal law, to try and convince you that something to do with blame might be what's important here. So there are a bunch of different reasons you might give for saying, well, why do we use a high standard of proof in the criminal law? Why do we use beyond reasonable doubt rather than balance of probabilities? And there's a bunch of things you might say, and I think many of them are broadly unconvincing. So one hypothesis might be that, well, we use the high standard of proof in the criminal law for broadly consequentialist reasons. It just promotes the good to use a high standard of proof in the criminal law. You're going to take some sort of utilitarian analysis, for example. So I think that's been convincingly shown not to work, right? Because what we don't do in the criminal law is optimize the standard of proof in order to maximize deterrence or maximize incapacitative value. So work by the late Larry Laudan, first famous philosopher of science, of course, then I think in his almost retirement became a criminal law theorist, as if to show how easy it was, I suppose. He sort of quite convincingly debunked the idea that the standard of proof in the criminal law optimizes consequentialist benefit, because he's argued that, for example, you could probably deter and incapacitate more effectively with a weaker standard of criminal proof than the beyond reasonable doubt standard. We certainly don't optimize. So the classic view is something like, well, actually it's to protect the innocent in some way. So one might say, well, what are we protecting the innocent from? One might think, well, it's something to do with punishment. Maybe punishment is especially harmful, and that's what we need to protect innocent members of society from if they're falsely convicted. But certainly it's not true across the board that punishment is more harmful than being the victim of a mistaken verdict in the civil law, right? So civil damages, torts, can lead to compensatory duties that are much more damaging to you as an individual than, for example, a fine might be or a week in prison, right? Some people, if they lose civil cases, they can be made bankrupt, their companies can be made bankrupt. There can be huge economic ramifications for losing civil cases that can dwarf, for example, the sanctions you might get for speeding or for a petty theft or something like this. So it's certainly not true across the board that the harm of punishment dwarfs the harm of being victim of a mistake in the civil law. So you might say, well, it's not about harm. Maybe it's some more deontic notion, for example, that punishment takes away your rights in a way that civil sanctions do not. So obviously, classic case of punishment is imprisonment. You lose your right to liberty in this case. But it's not really true, I think, that there's some clean distinction between rights being taken away in the criminal law versus the civil law. For example, what happens if you refuse to comply with a civil verdict? Well, at some point, some agents of the state are going to come along and enforce this verdict, and this is going to involve taking away your rights to property, for example, classic right that many think. So there's only a clean case to say that civil sanctions involve no loss of rights, while criminal sanctions do. There are certainly rights you lose when you lose a civil case, or you will lose rights as you refuse to comply with a civil case. Another thought might be more systemic, and you might think, well, the high standard of proof in criminal law is to protect individuals from the misuse of state power. You might think it's a sort of safeguard or a check on the ability the state has to criminalize, and of course states might use this ability unwisely, so the high standard of proof is a check on this. I'm not sure, well, this is just very sort of superficial response to this. I'm not sure that works at first glance. I mean, most state power is exercised through the civil law in many ways. Many of the ways the state can affect your life is through the exercise of civil law, through imposing constraints in the civil law. States can sue private parties. They can enforce these judgments. It doesn't seem to be obviously true that the specter of state misuse of power is more prominent in criminal law than civil law. There's also as much you could say about all of those hypotheses. We can discuss that more in Q&A, and in fact this talk isn't really trying to convince you of the falsity of any of these. It's just to sort of warm you up to the thought that none of these classic off-the-cuff justifications of the criminal standard seem to be obviously compelling. So another hypothesis that you found in recent literature ignores all of those other considerations and says, well, no, part of the justification for the high criminal standard of proof is because it involves or expresses moral blame when someone is found guilty. Something important to note here is that blame, to a large extent, is separable from punishment. Punishments can be separable from and indeed justified by considerations other than blame, and indeed you can be blamed by a criminal court without much substantial punishment. So many jurisdictions have an outcome in criminal cases called admonishment. So to be admonished is to just be told off. So in this case, there is no substantial punishment. All the judge does is he sort of wags his finger at you. But the thought is the criminal court here is expressing blame, even if there's no substantial punishment, because you're being admonished, you're being a naughty boy or girl. So why would we care about blame so much? Why would blame be so important that we need to be protected from it with a high standard of proof? So one thing you might think is just good to protect people from undeserved blame. However, I think this isn't an especially convincing vindication of the importance of the high standard, because why, after all, should we care so much about being undeservedly blamed? Sure, it's not nice to be blamed undeservedly. Indeed, it's not nice to be blamed at all, deserved or not. But certainly it's not nice to be blamed undeservedly. But it's not obvious why an individual defendant should rationally care more about blame than about, say, losing a civil case where there's lots of damages to be paid. So I don't think you can say that somehow being blamed is a especially harmful thing compared to civil damages, but I do think blame has an important role for other reasons. So one view that I'm sympathetic to is that if we think about what the social role of criminal verdicts is with respect to blame, this explains why we need to have a high standard of proof. So I can try and explain what I mean by this. So what's the role of a criminal trial? Well, from one perspective, what criminal trials do is they resolve disputes on behalf of the community. So it's not the case that as a community we can consider every case for ourselves. There are just too many allegations, too much evidence, and we have too little time. So what we do is we use trials as sort of trustees to resolve disagreements on our behalf. We trust trials to resolve the disagreement on our behalf in a way that allows us not to consider the case for ourselves, right? Because we can't consider every case for ourselves. So what we do is we delegate to trials to do it for us. So for this sort of delegation dynamic to work, for it to work that trials can be sort of delegates that resolve decisions for us, we've got to have certain attitudes towards the judgments that trials issue. We've got to have a certain type of trust in the decisions that criminal trials make. So if a criminal trial finds someone guilty of a crime, we as a community, even though we've not considered the evidence for ourselves, we have to think that this is an effective signal that the accused person is in fact guilty, and also that the subsequent treatment of the accused is, or at least can be, justified, right? Because otherwise the delegating role wouldn't work. If you have to second guess the outcome of every trial, then the trial's not really fulfilled its role of resolving disagreements on our behalf. You've got to take whatever the trial says on a type of trust, because you've got to think that the system is functioning effectively. So that's the thought, right? The thought is that criminal trials are meant to signal something about blame. We're meant to take from the outcome of a criminal trial something about blame, that it's at least permissible, we've got a license to blame the accused, even though we've not considered the evidence for ourselves. And in a way, so consider this alongside what's been an influential idea over the last sort of 10 years in epistemology and sort of psychology of blame, a view by Lara Buchak, and maybe some of you have come across it. So Buchak makes the following claim, that blame is a belief norm to practice. So what does she mean by this? She means it's only appropriate to blame someone if you fully believe that they are guilty. And you might think, well, that sounds like a platitude, but what's this, I suppose, contentful about this view is that she says you shouldn't blame someone if you think it's only likely that someone has been responsible for a wrong. So if you say you think it's 65% likely that someone's committed some wrong, that's not an appropriate basis on which to blame them. Rather, you've got to fully believe that they are guilty, that they're responsible or wrong. She thinks this is a truism not just about the law, but also about interpersonal practice, right? So I think there's something at least psychologically compelling about this. To blame someone, you've got to believe that they've done something wrong. And what do we mean by this? It means you've got to be so confident that you will sort of judge or affirm that they're guilty. You won't just say it's likely or it's probable. And there are cases you can use to motivate this. So suppose you have two kids and you go into the room and someone's drawn all over the wall in pen or crayon and you're really angry. You don't know which kid has done it, but you think that one of them is a bit more mischievous than the other one. So you think, well, it was probably little Annie or something, more likely than not. The thought would be you can't just go ahead and blame someone on the basis of a sort of probability. You've actually got to have evidence that makes you fully believe. You can't just say, well, it's more likely than not to be him or her, so I blame. Okay. So you put this together with this sort of influential bit of criminal theory that I sketched earlier, that criminal punishment and criminal verdicts are a way to express, and indeed they're a vehicle for blame. I think we see something quite interesting. Bear in mind, I've got this view of the criminal trial where it's meant to send a social signal. It's meant to send a social signal that we can find people responsible and blame them without having to consider the evidence for ourselves. This gives you a story, I think, for the demanding standard of proof in the criminal law. Criminal proof has to be of a certain type. It has to be a type that it can secure a public or a community-wide belief in guilt. Given what Lara Buchak says, that blame is a belief norm thing, the evidence that underpins a criminal verdict has to be strong enough to elicit a full belief in the mind of the public. It can't just be to say that it's likely the person's guilty. It has to say, no, look, you should believe fully that this person is guilty. So if you think the criminal verdict should play this type of social signalling role, I think this gives you quite an attractive picture of why the criminal standard of proof has to be as high as it is. For one, I mean, to see the importance of this, imagine this wasn't the case. Imagine that you couldn't sort of derive a belief in guilt from a criminal verdict. I think what would happen is the criminal justice system would lose all legitimacy, right? You wouldn't regard the treatment that people are exposed to after being found guilty as legitimate, because after all, you couldn't even blame them for what they've done. And of course, maybe you think the current world is like this. Maybe you think, given certain idiosyncratic features of the current world, you don't blame criminals. Well, in that case, you don't regard their punishment as legitimate. And that's a problem, presumably, if you think that. So in an ideal world, what a criminal justice system should do is it should secure its own legitimacy, right, by inspiring a full belief in someone's guilt and giving you a license to blame them. So that's a sort of sketch of how I think of these criminal trials, and that's a sketch of why I think that criminal trials need a high standard of proof. So where does this leave the civil law then? Well, although civil law involves lots of moral notions, forcing someone to pay restitutive damages, so damages that are merely compensatory, this is often said not to be blame expressing. So in order for the community to regard civil trials as legitimate, it might not require that civil verdicts need to underpin a full belief in guilt on behalf of the people who observe them. So I think that civil trials have, at least in schematic terms, a similar structure to criminal trials. What they do is they resolve disputes on behalf of the community. But when you're forced to pay civil damages, this often isn't thought to be a blame-expressing notion. Compensating someone, I think, isn't predicated on blame in the same way as punishment. So people often say that, well, restitution is meant to embody corrective justice, or it's going to be justified on consequentialist grounds, or some even say on redistributive grounds, but not based on the logic of punitive justice, which requires Blake. But of course, this doesn't mean that the community shouldn't take any interest in the legitimacy of these sanctions, right? So for one, imposing civil sanctions is underpinned by the coercive power of the state. It's done on behalf of the community. In the most banal sense, people's tax money goes towards underpinning the civil courts and the coercive agents that follow from civil judgments. So the community's got to take an interest in what makes these sanctions legitimate. And what legitimacy requires, at least, is that responsibility is established on some appropriate epistemic standard, right? On some appropriate basis of evidence and proof. So what sort of signal do civil courts give out under the sort of classic balance of probabilities system? So balance of probabilities just means more likely than not. So what can you as a citizen read off of this social signal? If I say it's more likely than not that someone has been negligent, what are you entitled to derive from this? Well, it's actually highly underdetermined, right? So to say something's more likely than not is just to say there's a greater than sort of 50% chance that it happened. And that's compatible with a large range of confidence intervals, right? And you might think it's certain it happened, you might think it's 70% likely it happened, or you might just think it's 51% likely it happened, right? So saying something's proven on the balance of probabilities is compatible with this great range of confidence intervals. Some of these confidence intervals will be strong enough to support a belief. So if you think it's certain something that happened, right, you're entitled to believe it happened. But if you think it's only 51% likely something happened, you're probably not entitled to have a full belief that it happened, right? So civil law really, unlike criminal law, right, because if you think something's proven beyond a reasonable doubt, you're entitled to believe it. Civil law radically underdetermines what the appropriate rational response is, right? Some civil cases will be the type that should inspire belief that the person is responsible, while other civil cases should just make you think, well, it's actually very unclear, but I suppose I'd say it's more likely than not. There's this huge range. As an aside, this is not unique to civil law, so not guilty verdicts, acquittals in the criminal law are also like this. So if you say someone's not guilty of a crime, what does this mean? Well, it means their guilt hasn't been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And what does that mean? Well, it might mean you're sort of certain that they're innocent, or it might mean actually, I think there's like very likely this person is guilty, but I still have some reasonable doubts. So when you acquit someone of a crime in the criminal law, there's also this huge range of confidence intervals that you might have towards their guilt. All it does is it rules out the very highest ones. This is why people who are accused of crimes still often suffer social ostracism or stigma, right? Because the public are quite rightly entitled to say, your innocence hasn't been proven. All that happened is that your guilt wasn't proven. And there's a very big difference between these things, right? So given that civil verdicts, strictly speaking, only say that it's more likely than not that someone's responsible, what does this mean for the question of us holding someone responsible for a fault? I think this is where my talk probably enters into the territory with which I'm least comfortable and actually the stuff I want the most help with. So my question is, well, is there any notion of responsibility that is what you might term a sub-belief notion of responsibility? So what do I mean by a sub-belief notion? I mean some level of confidence that's below that required to have an outright belief. Is there a notion of responsibility that we can attribute as citizens that doesn't require we fully believe the person is responsible? Is there any sort of interpersonal analogue of sub-belief attributions of responsibility? Or does the civil law do something sort of unique and sui generis? Is it sort of making up a notion of responsibility that actually has no root in our interpersonal practices? And it's actually quite hard, I think. This is the great thing about giving talks. Maybe you can show me that it's actually very easy. I think it's actually quite hard to come up with a interpersonal comparison case when we attribute responsibility without full belief. Here's a case where you might think it is at least one within the range of reasonable responses. So suppose you are hanging out with some friends you, A, another person, B, and you get so drunk that you obliterate all of your memory. Happens sometimes. So you're in a third party C's house, so it can be an acquaintance, a friend, you can fill in the details in whatever way it makes my scenario most plausible. So suppose everyone wakes up and you find that the third party C's television at some point has been smashed to pieces, right? In this drunken haze, the television has been smashed. It's granted that whoever smashed the TV was acting negligently, because after all, you were very drunk. So suppose that negligence is baked into the picture. But the thing is, you don't know who smashed the television. But you do know that person A spent a lot more time in the living room than person B. You all spent some time in the living room, but it's person A spent more time there. Suppose they slept there while B slept in a spare bedroom. After discussion, right, suppose you decide to attribute responsibility to person A for smashing the TV, because they spent most time in the place where the TV was. It could have been the other person, it could have been person B, but you decide on the balance of the evidence you should attribute responsibility to person A, and the fair thing for them to do would be to compensate person C for the television. This seems, maybe this is marginal, but this seems arguably a case where the evidence doesn't support a full belief in guilt. And it might not even support blame, right? Because, again, those two things go together. The evidence doesn't support an outright belief in guilt. Therefore, it doesn't support blame. But you still might, as a collective, think that the fair and just thing to do is to attribute responsibility, given that it's more likely than not that that person's responsible. That's not the only way you might solve this case, of course. I mean, you might also go for some type of shared liability or shared responsibility, which, interestingly, there are analogues of this in the civil law. So think about cases involving market share liability or litigation on asbestos. It doesn't matter if you think that's another or even a better way to deal with this case. All it needs to be so for this idea of sub-belief responsibility to work is that this is within the reasonable range of options that one might have to this case, right? It doesn't have to be the best option, just within the reasonable range. Because what I'm trying to suggest, tentatively, is that this idea of sub-belief responsibility isn't completely unknown to interpersonal practice, right? It's actually one we can work with. And in fact, many classic tort cases, you can think of this. So, classic tort case is someone's in a shop, the sign of the shop falls on their head. It's unclear whether it was a freak accident or whether the sign had been installed negligently. So that's a case of normative uncertainty. Well, the case I've given is a case of factual uncertainty. Both are relevant to the civil law. Again, you might think we can't believe outright that the shopkeeper is negligent, right? We don't have strong enough evidence to blame them, because after all, it could have been the wind. It might not have been their negligence. But given the balance of the evidence, we think it's appropriate to assign responsibility. Okay. So, bear that in mind. So, final section. Given what we said at the very start of the talk, given the ubiquity of moral notions in the civil law, it seems hard to avoid concluding that moral notions often play a central role in many civil cases. To the extent that full belief in someone's fault and the preconditions for assigning this fault would imply moral blame for the defendant. So if you fully believed that the person smashed the TV, you'd be entitled to blame them morally for their negligence, right? I think that's hard to avoid. But what I've tried to suggest is that even if we accept this, there is a type of responsibility attribution that's intelligible not just to the law, but also to humans, which is an attribution of sub-belief responsibility, one that doesn't imply moral blame, but you still think it's inappropriate to treat someone as responsible and ask them to compensate. So we've got this case where civil verdicts, at least on their face, they're compatible with either two ways of reacting to them, right? One is to infer that someone's either fully morally responsible and therefore open to blame, or that they're only open to this sort of sub-belief notion of responsibility that I've been trying to explore. So maybe one way we can think about civil law is as the following. What they do is they merely license this idea of sub-belief responsibility rather than full moral responsibility. If we had a civil system that had stronger verdicts with a very high standard of proof, then it would be completely true that people would be allowed to infer full moral responsibility from a civil case. So if the standard of proof in civil cases was beyond reasonable doubt, it would be true, just as it's true in the criminal law, that people would be allowed to infer full moral responsibility and blame for people who have lost civil cases. But that's not the system we have, right? We have this much weaker system where the standard of proof is merely on the balance of probabilities. So all this technically licenses us to do is to infer that we have something weaker than this full blame-permitting liability. We just have this sub-belief notion of responsibility. So what I guess I'm suggesting here is, while it might initially seem that the use of a weaker standard of proof in the civil law is a big problem, given that there's lots of moral blame notions in the neighbourhood, what it actually does is it sort of rescues the civil law from this problematic implication. Because what the weak standard of proof does is it precludes us from seeing civil law cases as licensing moral blame. And of course, you might be thinking at this point, well, this is problematic because, of course, people do often infer full moral responsibility from civil cases, right? At least members of the public often do see a civil verdict as a license to blame. So you often hear in casual talk, people say, well, the court proved that, say, Johnny Depp is a domestic abuser, or that someone, this politician's corrupt, or that that person's negligent, right? This is a very common way to talk. People read that there's been a civil verdict against a person, and they say, well, that, look, the court proved it, so we're entitled to talk and act as if they're morally responsible. But technically speaking, this is a mistake, right? This isn't what civil courts license people, should license people to think, right? When the courts, suppose the court says, it's on the balance of probabilities that Johnny Depp was a domestic abuser. The court's only saying there's a chance greater than 0.5 that Johnny Depp was a domestic abuser, right? And that's obviously compatible with this huge confidence range. So when people make this claim that it allows us to morally blame, I think what they're doing is they're making a type of mistake, right? And it's a fairly understandable mistake because public fluency and knowledge about the intricacies of the legal system is very poor in most places. Most people wouldn't be able to give an adequate explanation of the procedural differences between a criminal and civil verdict. So this, what this does is that this causes people to infer the much stronger thing from what is actually a much, much weaker social signal. So then you might say, well, is this something the court should care about? Should the court care about people inferring the stronger thing from the weaker signal? Should the court care about, for example, the social stigma that people face after being found guilty in the civil law? This is a difficult question. So at least if we look at the analogy with criminal law, the criminal law generally is completely indifferent to people's social stigma that they might face after a verdict. So as I said earlier, when the court finds someone not guilty of a crime, this is compatible with lots of different levels of confidence in their guilt, right? You might think, well, I'm actually really quite confident they're guilty, but it just wasn't quite proven to the rigor required by the criminal law. Criminal courts care not a bit for this, right? Criminal courts care not at all for social stigma that acquitted defendants face. One way to see this is to consider, well, criminal courts could use a richer set of verdicts, right? Criminal courts could acquit people with an innocent verdict, a verdict that says... So, actually, there's a real-life example. So in Scotland, there are three criminal verdicts, right? One is guilty, there's another verdict of not guilty, and there's an in-the-middle verdict of not proven. And what this does is the court actually licenses a much more fine-grained level of confidence to the person's accusation. So courts that are really concerned with avoiding social stigma could use a richer verdict scheme. In the same way, the civil law could use a richer verdict scheme too. You could have civil verdicts that are proven on the balance of probabilities, and you could also have civil verdicts that are proven on a much higher standard, like beyond reasonable doubt. But the civil law, just as with the criminal law, declines to use these richer verdict schemes. So at least technically, courts don't care a bit for the stigma that people might face. And when members of the community infer the stronger thing, the moral blame, from the weaker thing, which is the signal that civil courts give out when they find someone responsible. But of course, there might still be a lingering sense of injustice about this, right? For civil defendants who are blamed as if the evidence supports their guilt to a very high probability, when actually all it does is support this, what I've called this sub-belief notion of responsibility. And of course, there's obvious remedies to this, and this would be to remedy it with greater improving understanding of what civil courts do, and I think this is something that's somewhat neglected in legal theory, is the fact that we often talk about legitimacy, but in practice, in reality, people's level of understanding is pretty poor, and I think this is generally a blocker to fully legitimate legal processes. Of course, I don't want to suggest from any of this that civil defendants are not often morally responsible for wrongdoing. In fact, I think most civil... It's often the case that civil defendants are both responsible for moral wrongs and the evidence is strong enough for people to blame them. All I'm saying is that if you look at the technical content of the court verdict, it doesn't license us to blame them. But of course, what it might do is it might invite us to consider the evidence firsthand. So remember earlier I said what the courts do? They allow us to form opinions and judgments without considering the evidence for ourselves. But of course, we can also do the further thing. We can also consider the evidence for ourselves and then form a judgment that's more informed, that's richer than the one that's licensed to us by the court, right? So you might say, well, hey, I'm actually very interested in this case, this Johnny Depp case or whatever. I'm going to look at the evidence for myself. And then once you do that, and if you say the evidence is overwhelming, it entitles me to believe fully the person's guilty, then you can go ahead and morally blame just as you would morally blame anyone in your interpersonal life. So now, I'm not saying, for example, you can't blame civil defendants. I'm just saying to do that, what you should do is consider the evidence for yourself. Because technically what the civil verdict does, merely does, is it only licenses you to think it's more likely than not the person's guilty. And that, at least typically, isn't thought to be strong enough to license moral blame. So that's for all for the body of the talk. I suppose there's some final complications here that you might wonder about. So one, for example, is what should we say about civil verdicts that do seem to be punitive in nature or have punitive consequences? So in the US, for example, there are various situations in which people can be liable for punitive damages that seem to go beyond mere restitution. And you might think, well, do punitive damages not require to be underpinned by full moral blame for them to be legitimate? I don't have any particularly sort of deeper insightful thing to say about these. I think I certainly feel no imperative to vindicate every aspect of current legal practice. So, I mean, as you know, legal systems evolve piecemeal over time. Not every aspect of a legal system is going to be consistent with your best theory about how a legal system should operate. There's often appendages to the law, or the law evolves in ways that might not be consistent with the underlying sort of justificatory principles. So, if it turns out that certain aspects of civil law, such as the use of punitive damages, are not readily sort of justifiable or rationalizable given what I've said, as long as these are sufficiently peripheral, I suppose I'm quite happy with that. And I think there are lots of questions about punitive damages, right, that I think are deeply puzzling and indeed problematic. So if there are these peripheral examples, I don't take it to be especially problematic from my view. Although, of course, I can't play that game forever. If there are enough examples that I can't fit into the system, I can't just keep saying, well, I'm not particularly concerned with those peripheral things. Maybe in the questions you'll convince me that everything's peripheral, actually. Anyway, that's all I've got for you today, but thanks for listening.